offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. The listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. In the series, we go through the 1991 summer course series. In fact, we are right in the end of that series. We're going through the last discourse, the 13th discourse, the discourse that Swami delivered on the 2nd of June, 1991. This entire series has been on many of the Upanishads. For those of you who have been following us all through the good part of last year and this year, this particular discourse is a very general one, pretty much like the first discourse in most of the summer courses, where Swami speaks about Indian culture and Swami speaks about culture itself. Well, this one, the last discourse, is about the concept of dharma, which is very, very important. As we go through this discourse, we can see how much importance Swami gives to this concept. We've, of course, heard Swami speak extensively about it. Swami has written a beautiful treatise called the Dharmavahini on the concept of dharma. So before we progress into this discourse, we've played about 4 clips already, and let's see how many we can play today. But before that, and before we summarize what we've heard so far, let's, as always, invite Hari to join all of us. Saram Hari.
Saram Prem.
And talking about dharma, I mean, so many times we've heard Swami speaking about dharma, and especially when he speaks about Ramayana, when he speaks about Mahabharata, even in this discourse, Swami makes references to those epics. And talking about dharma, I very fondly recall a beautiful incident from my university days. You know, we all have this concept of giving a name for your class, right? I think just 3 or 4 weeks back, I was sharing it on the other program. Each of us, you know, call ourselves something. The class is called something. Yeah, I think a senior batch was called Samaritans, and one batch was called Peace Pilgrims. And so, I mean, you kind of, I think, what is your batch? Okay, Peace Pilgrims is your batch. So, you know, we would come up with all these kind of names, but there was a trend by for a few years, most of these names were English names.
Yeah.
So when it came to our turn, you know, we said we have to stand apart, and the only way we could do that, I mean, or the obvious way we could do that is come up with a Sanskrit name, right? So we said, all right, that was decided. We're going to go with a Sanskrit name. But we didn't know what to do. And around that time, when we had to make that decision of what we're going to call ourselves, one of my classmates, Swami used to talk to him every day. Every day after morning bhajans in Vrindavan, Swami used to call him for an interview, and or he would be present in other people's interview. You know, sometimes that happens. Swami would bless a student like that. So we went and pestered him, and he said, you know, you should go and ask Swami for a class name. And now looking back, it really is so beautiful that Swami allowed us all those such things and gave us that space. So we told this boy, you know, you have to go and ask Swami about this. And finally he got convinced, and he went and asked Swami. And you had to explain to Swami what it is, right? You can't go and tell Swami, Swami, give us a class name. And Swami will say, what nonsense is that? So, you know, very, very rigorously he explained to Swami that, Swami, every batch has a name. And they call themselves, and they, you know, associate themselves with that name. Swami said, why, what name? Swami, some name which should inspire the whole batch, all the students. And we will be very happy if Swami gives a name. And Swami like, what name I'll give? So he said, Swami, we want some name from Indian culture which can inspire us. Okay? And when this much was said, Swami's spontaneous answer was, if you want like that, there's only one name, Swami said. And then Swami said, that name is Dharma. He said, one concept from Indian culture which can inspire young people, old people, all ages and all sex, for eternity, is this word Dharma. Swami said, and of course we very, very gleefully accepted that name. But, I mean, that was so spontaneous when Swami was asked this question of, is there a concept in Indian culture which can inspire? And without a moment's hesitation, Swami said it has to be Dharma. Right? And so when Swami is speaking so much about Dharma, literally saying that, you know, this is what is the foundation for Indian culture itself, the concept of Dharma, what you're supposed to do at each situation, at each stage of life, right?
It actually is the answer to so many questions, no? Like,
right.
Of course, it raises its own questions, but at the same time, you know, some people always are faced with this, that in family life, right, at they're faced with this, that the spiritual life calls for a lot of detachment, whereas family life is almost by definition attachment.
Right.
And it's very difficult to reconcile the two, and everybody, you know, it may not be merely attachment to your family. You're attached to so many things. We are attached to our beliefs. We are attached to our work.
Mm.
And there are so many things that we are, that we do get attached to. Attachment causes a lot of pain. So there's that question, eternal question, like, well, how do I practice detachment while in the world? Like, mm. does it mean I have to, because Swami on the one hand has said, no, you're heads in the forest,
right,
but hands in society. And if you're in society, attachment is something that happens so naturally, right? And so, that's why if you see the entire Ramayana, character after character, what is emphasized is dharma, their duty.
Mm.
If you look at the way Lakshmana serves Rama, there is the undercurrent of being the brother, but at the same time, he sees it as a duty. So everything is seen. there is the love, of course, that Rama has towards his father. But the relationship is entirely built on his dharma as a son.
Right.
And you can see that every single relationship there, we do not speak of the love. You know, that love is expressed as following the dharma that is appropriate to that relationship.
Right.
That is how. Even if you see in our culture, it like, at least in my generation, that is my mother's generation, there was no such concept called like a mother telling her son or the son telling the mother, I love you. Nowadays it is definitely prevalent. But I was just thinking that in our time it was not. And even the kids, sometimes they ask, you know, how would you know?
Mm.
And because what we saw was the mother doesn't need to tell the child that it loves the child. So where does it get expressed in its actions? In the actions the mother does, right? It is there in that she does her dharma to the child, and that is love.
Right.
So that was how the main thing to understand is that therefore love is not merely a feeling. Love is a set of actions,
right,
which
very
are consistent
true.
With dharma.
Feeling,
so
right.
Most of us tend to mistake love with a feeling that is inside. Like even if you see fathers, right? So Indian fathers generally are not very expressive of their affection, or at least I'm talking of our generation,
right,
or what they have learned from their parents. So where did we get that signal that our parents actually love us? They didn't need to show it in any which way, like hugging or any of those ways, right? We got it because of how they stood for us, the kind of things they did for us, right? So that expressed their love for us,
right.
not in words, not in shows of affection, but this is what we got was their love.
Right. And talking about love and dharma, which is actually a very, very important topic, which generally we take it very lightly. I mean, you're talking about our expressing that love verbally to parents. I mean, we don't know whether we show it in action as much as we speak it sometimes. And same is the case even with Swami. I mean, you know, we would find a lot of people who say, oh, I love Swami so much. But when it comes to action, you know, these are things, it's okay, but I love Swami. It doesn't work like that. You know, Swami would say that if you love me, you have to show it in action. You have to show it in obedience. And that's where we miss out. I think many times, even I've made a reference to some of my, you would see this even among Swami's students. They would say, no, Swami says that love is more important and loving Swami is enough. Loving Swami is everything, but that love, as you're saying, that also has a few ways by which it has to be expressed. In fact, there's that very beautiful conversation with the depiction of the scene where Rama says that I will not come back to Ayodhya, and Bharata says that if you don't come back, I'll stay back here. There is that duel between Bharata and Rama. Well, Rama is saying that this is my duty. I've given a word to my father, I'll have to stay on. So Bharata says that, you know, this is my devotion asking you to change your mind. So I think this was enacted quite a few times in Swami's presence. In one of those dramas, there is the scene where finally King Janaka is brought in to mediate between the two, because he's a jnani by his right. So he comes, and then the first thing which he says is, you know, love is the greatest. So love is superior and love overrules everything else. So in that sense, he literally declares Bharata as superior and Bharata as the winner. So Rama has to follow Bharata. Then after that, he has that beautiful part where he says, but you should remember that even prema has a dharma. Even love has its duty. And the moment you say that I love the Lord, I am devoted to the Lord, the dharma becomes to accept whatever the Lord chooses. Whatever the Lord wants becomes your, command.
Right.
So that very, very beautiful point where, there is no distinction between love and dharma then. And as Swami would say, the dharma becomes so spontaneous. In fact, I think we have spoken about this before also, where Swami would sometimes perform his actions like it is a duty. And, and that line between dharma and love actually vanishes when Swami is performing something.
Yes, we were speaking about this in another context, I think, with Raghu. A conversation long back about seva. And some of it came up, what the kind of compassion that Swami is to show. Like, I think the incident that would trigger is like an interaction that happened between Swami and the warden of the institute, of the hostel. So he was pleading on behalf of one student.
Okay.
That Swami, your punishment to the student is very severe. Mm-hmm. He's really undergoing a lot of trouble. So Swami's trump card, was to ask the warden if by any chance the warden was under the illusion that he had more compassion than Bhagwan.
Right.
So that was totally left the warden mute. He had simply no reply to that. And that, even as he was talking about love, I have seen that how Swami out of love can even send a person out of his presence.
Mm.
Various students I know very, very attached to Swami. And Swami was very, on the physical level, very, very attached to them. Shown enormous amount of grace. But they tell me, the students of that time, they tell me that finally on the day when it came to leave, Swami would be very categorical. You have to go out. If you continue to stay here, the next set of students, where will they sit? He used to tell them like that, but it was clinical. Like Swami would say, like, go out. There is of course the fact that for Swami, at the physical level, the kind of interaction or presence that he has is a very small aspect of his entire interaction with a devotee. That being true, but you could see, that Swami was well aware of the pain that it caused them. And I know from people who used to stay with Swami that he used to, at a physical level, also undergo that pain of this thing. But at the same time, there was the kind of compassion that Swami shows is a brand called ruthless compassion.
Right.
It's not the one that you and I are used to, which is where we have to distinguish between the feeling and what you call prema with dharma.
Right.
That clinical kind of prema, which is very, very difficult to execute.
Mm.
And it has to come from an enormous amount of love. Not the love which is afraid of losing a person. Mm. That love which really wants the best for that person.
Mm.
Yeah, that is something you have to, you watch Swami. And a lot of the scriptures make a lot of sense.
But that's the beautiful point, I think we've might have made a mention of it in the passing. When you talk about qualities like satya, dharma, shanti, prema, the human values, the whole of life is an attempt to master these things or perform these things to perfection.
Correct.
But Swami would say that when you are perfect already, which if you look at Swami, when we refer to Swami, it's like operating from that level of love all the time, then the satya, dharma, shanti, prema is no more in the realm of effort. It has becomes a realm of expression. You automatically do what has to be done. And you don't go around talking about it, I have done so much, I have done this. I think many times, even if you look at our relationship with Swami, we tend to do that. I have sacrificed so much for Swami. I have given so many years of my life. Or I could have been elsewhere, I am here. I think all that is a sign of imperfection in love, because once love is there, that separation between I have done something for Swami does not exist at all. Doing the right thing or doing the best becomes the most spontaneous thing to do, because that's how Swami was. In fact, there was a beautiful interaction which we witnessed where Swami was telling a very elderly couple that Swami is asking them, when is your Shashti Purti? The husband turned 60 and marriage is performed again for the couple. That's the Indian tradition. So Swami is asking the couple, when is your Shashti Purti? And that person said that Swami the next year or something like that. And Swami paused for a moment and Swami said, I'll perform it. You come to Parthi, I'll perform. And that the couple understandably were overwhelmed and they were shedding tears. And Swami turned to all of us. We were sitting around Swami. And Swami said, you know, I only performed their wedding also. Swami said, I performed the wedding. I'm going to perform their Shashti Purti also. So the couple literally got up and fell at Swami's feet and said, Swami, so much grace Swami is showering on us. Swami said, no, it is my duty, it is your right. I mean, that statement for Swami to make was so beautiful because Swami is saying that I'm not, you know, doing something, don't look at, I mean, it is an act of such grace, but Swami is saying this is my duty. I mean, when Swami is showering his grace, he speaks of it as duty. But you know, when we do something for Swami, we talk of it as, you know, I am sacrificing Swami and I am doing work for Swami. I think that is the level where Swami wants us to operate from, where the moment you say that, Swami, I am your devotee, Swami, I love you, I am in this, I am going to operate from this level, then I think obedience and, as you are saying, the things which fall as dharma for a devotee, all of that happens pretty spontaneously.
No, that kind of association with Swami, no? I remember, so the first one way of interacting with Swami, I used to write letters to Swami regularly as a student. And I used to always write, you know, your loving son at the end. Till one of my teachers, he so beautifully, he told, like by chance I heard this, you know. He said that he used to write letters to Swami and he used to write like your loving son at the end. And then one day Swami actually corrected him. He said, see, even when you say your loving son, right, now you're, that is a relationship between this body, your body and this body, right? You should always say your loving child. Right, that child is, that is a relationship that you have with me, not as a son or as a daughter, as a child, right? That's that next level of engagement, right? Where you, so this becomes so very intimate with Bhagwan. See, we there are so many ways, of course, of engaging with the Lord, but in this, what I found is that what you talked about, you kind of own Swami,
right?
Right, and there is that, you know, the kind of love that you have towards your father, mother, that kind of affinity, and the question therefore of effort for Bhagwan, that disappears. It becomes your natural way of being. That so the Swami used to correct, you know, not a loving son, not a loving daughter, but a loving child. That kind of,
you know, that's the beauty of, you know, Swami. That's the opportunity I think you get when in Swami's presence. Because Swami is saying that, I mean, to an extent it is easier to have that sort of a relationship with Swami, right? You know, you can do something, you can probably work in Radio Sahaja, you can work in Central Trust, and it's easier to say I'm doing this for Swami. Because we literally are doing it for Swami. The challenge is, after that, taking it home and doing whatever you do and saying that this also I'm doing it for Swami.
Yes.
Because in Bhagavad Gita, Swami says, in Gita Vaini, I think Swami says, every task should eventually become an offering. That whatever you're doing as karma, as dharma, as your responsibility roles, eventually has to be attached to God and made an offering. Unless that happens, you're not going to progress to the next level. So the same idea of, you know, I'm doing this, but it's not like I'm stressing myself out and doing this as an offering to Swami. Becomes very natural that I'm doing this for Swami, so I mean, no trouble is any trouble for me. The same attitude when it comes to everyday life. You do whatever you do for your children, whatever you do for your wife, whatever you do for your parents. You're not doing it for them, but you're doing it for Swami. And they are the people who kind of, you know, inspire you to do it in the immediate sense. I think that is the challenge. Take this relationship which we have with Swami to every relationship that we encounter in life, be it a boss, a colleague, a person on the road that you meet. It's much easier said than done, but I think at least we know the syllabus. Right? Right. So I think that was precisely the point we were in last week. Last week or the week before that, we spoke about, Swami spoke about the German philosopher who chanced upon a copy of the Manu Dharma, and he was so fascinated by what Manu Dharma had to say and the nuances of dharma which was spoken in that. And I think very beautifully you had spoken about how dharma is actually different from ethics and morality, from some of the more recent philosophers, how they look at it, and how some of these ancient scriptures are very, very deep, because they see it in a different perspective, and that's what Swami is making a reference to. And Swami was saying that it comes because of the... each country has a different approach to morality, ethics, and knowledge itself. And that's what makes each one special in their own way. It's not like this is superior to that. But if you understand and study each one in the context of that country, in the history of that country, context of the history of the country, then you understand it better. And I think that was what Swami was telling. There is no religion, there is no science, there is no study which can put down what Vedanta says, what Manu Dharma says. Because this has its own context and this has its own value. And to understand it and derive the best benefit from it, you'll have to look at it in that context. That's what I think Swami was saying. Science is, Swami was saying that science gives a theory today and it refutes it tomorrow. And how can such a science talk about some of these ancient concepts which have lasted for centuries together?
Yes. Because one of the premises of all the Dharma Sutras and the Manu Dharma which we spoke about is it comes from a place that that we are speaking about a divine person, no? We're not trying to limit a person or actually convey to a person that this is how you should lead your life. This says that since you are divine, these are the acts that follow.
Right.
So that is the basic premise being that. And that and the promise at the end that, you know, when you follow the Dharma, which is appropriate to you, right? Then it is a means of enlightenment by itself.
Right.
So that places it at a higher pedestal than reward and punishment as a premise.
As a temporary heaven or hell. Takes it beyond that.
Yes. Right.
In fact, I think one of the discourses earlier, it was so beautifully Swami, I think one of the Prashnopanishad discourses, where Swami says, the difference between Uttarayanam and Dakshinayanam. Swami says that you can do the best of acts, but if you do it with benefits in your mind, you only go till heaven.
Yes.
And I mean, the greatness of the scripture is it speaks of heaven and hell as not the ultimate. You don't have eternal damnation, you don't have the idea of heaven where you rest in peace ever after. Both of it is not there. So kind of literally taking away the idea that you can do good with an end in mind. You have to do good for good's sake. And I think that's where it takes it to a different level. Swami was saying that how this German philosopher is really fascinated by that depth of the Manu Dharma which he read. So I think we'll go to the next clip and we'll see what Swami has to say there.
All the achievements that have been attained in today's science,
ఆనాడు కృతయుగమ లోపల హిరణ్యాక్షుడు హిరణ్యకశిపుడు సాధించినటువంటి పరిశోధనల కంటే ఎక్కువైనటువంటివి కావు.
Are not in great comparison to the researches done by Hiranyakashipu or Hiranyaksha in Krita Yuga in the days of yore.
హిరణ్యకశిపుడు భూమిని శోధించాడు.
Hiranyakashipu investigated the earth.
ఆకాశాన్ని శోధించాడు.
He investigated the sky.
సముద్రాన్ని శోధించాడు.
He investigated the oceans.
పంచభూతములను హస్తగతం గావించాడు.
He has completely gained control over 5 elements.
సర్వము కూడాను తన యొక్క చేతిలోనే ఉన్నదని గర్వించాడు.
He prided himself that everything was in his hands.
ఈ అహంకారము చేత,
due to this ego,
కన్ను నిన్ను కానక,
becoming blinded, he tortured even his own son. So what is it that was gained out of these researches? He develops an ego that makes one forget oneself. Because of this ego, the distinction between mine and thine vanishes.
కొడుకే తల్లే బిడ్డనే అనేటువంటి ఒక తారతమ్యమే లేకుండా పోతుంది.
దేర్ ఇస్ నో డిస్టింక్షన్ బిట్వీన్ సన్ మదర్ అండ్ ద డాటర్.
దేనినైనా కూడా తన యొక్క ఆశకు, తన యొక్క భావమునకు, తన యొక్క కాంక్షకు అడ్డు తగిలినప్పుడు దేనినైనా కూడా ఖండించడానికి సిద్ధమవుతాడు.
వాట్ ఎవర్ ఇట్ మే బి దట్ ఇస్ అబ్స్ట్రక్టింగ్ వన్స్ డిజైర్, ఫీలింగ్ ఆర్ నీడ్, వన్ ఇస్ ప్రిపేర్డ్ టు కండెమ్ ఇట్.
కట్టకడెప్పటికీ తనకు కొడుకే తనకు గొప్ప పాఠమును నేర్పుతూ వచ్చాడు. కుమారుడు హరిప్రియుడు, తండ్రి హరిద్వేషి.
At last, his son Prahalada started teaching lessons to him. Son is a lover of Lord Hari and father is a hater of Lord Hari. These two didn't go well with each other. So today, there seems to be a conflict between spiritual knowledge and worldly knowledge.
కానీ ఏనాటికైనా ఈ తత్వశాస్త్రము ఈ భౌతిక శాస్త్రం బుద్ధి చెప్పక తప్పదు.
బట్ సమ్ డే ఆర్ ది అదర్ స్పిరిచువల్ నాలెడ్జ్ ఇస్ బౌండ్ టు ఎన్లైటన్ వరల్డ్లీ నాలెడ్జ్.
ఎక్కడ ఉన్నాడు నీ దేవుడు అని ప్రశ్నించాడు హిరణ్యకశిపుడు.
హిరణ్యకశిపు క్వశ్చన్, వేర్ ఈజ్ యువర్ గాడ్?
ఇందుకలడు అందులేదని సందేహమే వలదు అన్నాడు.
డోంట్ హ్యావ్ డౌట్ దట్ హీస్ ప్రెసెంట్ హియర్ అండ్ నాట్ దేర్, హీ సెడ్.
అయితే ఈ స్తంభములో ఉన్నాడా?
సో ఇస్ హీ ప్రెసెంట్ ఇన్ దిస్ పిల్లర్?
ఉన్నాడన్నాడు.
Yes, he replied.
దానిని గద్దలు చేసేటప్పటికి అందులో దివ్యశక్తి ఆవిర్భవించింది.
As he broke it open, a divine power manifested out of it.
దీని యొక్క అంతరార్థం ఏమిటి?
What is the inner significance of this?
ఎంతకాలము మానవుడు దేహభ్రాంతిని కలిగి దేహాభిమానంతో జీవిస్తూ ఉంటాడో అంతకాలము దైవం అతనికి అత్యంత దూరంగా ఉంటాడు.
So long as man is caught in the delusion of the body and lives with body attachment, God will be distant from him.
ఏనాడు దేహ భ్రాంతిని విసర్జించి దైవ భ్రాంతిని అభివృద్ధి పరుచుకున్నో ఆనాడే అతనికి దివ్యత్వం అర్థమవుతుంది.
The day the delusion that one is the body is given up and attachment towards God is developed, that day divinity would be understood. Therefore, Hiranyakashipu broke body consciousness. Out of that, divinity manifested. This is an important episode in the life of Hiranyakashipu.
Kanuka bhautika vijnanam anetundi manamu atyavasarame.
So physical knowledge is indeed necessary for us.
తద్వారా మనము మితిమీరినటువంటి అహంకారాన్ని పెంచుకోరాదు.
బట్ ఆన్ అకౌంట్ ఆఫ్ దాట్ వీ షుడ్ నాట్ డెవలప్ లిమిట్లెస్ ఈగో.
ఇంకనూ తెలుసుకోవాల్సింది ఎంతయో ఉన్నదని గుర్తించి వినయ విధేయతతో తాము జీవించడానికి ప్రయత్నించాలి.
అండర్స్టాండింగ్ ద ట్రూత్ దట్ దెర్ ఇస్ లాట్ మోర్ టు లర్న్, వన్ షుడ్ ట్రై టు ఎంబార్క్ ఆన్ లీడింగ్ అ లైఫ్ ఆఫ్ హ్యూమిలిటీ అండ్ ఒబీడియన్స్.
విద్యార్థులారా,
Students,
మీరు ముందు దేశానికి నాయకులు కావాల్సినటువంటి వారు.
యూ గోయింగ్ టు బి ద లీడర్స్ ఆఫ్ ద నేషన్ ఇన్ ఫ్యూచర్.
దేశం యొక్క మంచి చెడ్డలంతా కూడా మీ తలవాత పైననే ఆధారపడి ఉంటుండాలి.
ద నేషన్స్ వెల్ఫేర్ అండ్ డౌన్ ఫాల్ డిపెండ్స్ ఆన్ యువర్ డెస్టినీ.
మీరు మంచివారైనప్పుడే దేశం మంచిదవుతుంది.
ఇఫ్ యు ఆర్ గుడ్, దెన్ ద నేషన్ విల్ బి గుడ్.
మీరు దుర్మార్గులైనప్పుడే దేశం దుర్మార్గంగా మారిపోతుంది.
ఇఫ్ యు ఆర్ వికెడ్, దెన్ ద నేషన్ వుడ్ షేప్ ఇన్ టు వికెడ్ వన్.
కనుక మీరందరూ కూడా ఈ వైజ్ఞాన విచారం ముందు చక్కగా విచారణ సల్పాలి.
సో ఆల్ ఆఫ్ యూ మస్ట్ ఎన్క్వైర్ డీప్లీ ఇన్ టు ద నేచర్ ఆఫ్ సైంటిఫిక్ నాలెడ్జ్.
ఈనాటి విద్యార్థులలో ఆవగింజంతా ఆంగ్ల విద్యను నేర్చుకుంటే గుమ్మడికాయంత అహం ప్రవేశిస్తుంటుండాలి.
ఇన్ స్టూడెంట్స్ ఆఫ్ టుడే, వెన్ దే లెర్న్ అ టింజ్ ఆఫ్ ఇంగ్లీష్ ద సైజ్ ఆఫ్ అ మస్టర్డ్ సీడ్, దే డెవలప్ ఈగో ఆఫ్ ద సైజ్ ఆఫ్ అ పంప్కిన్.
ఇది చాలా విరుద్ధమైనటువంటిది. ఇది మంచిది కాదు.
దిస్ ఇస్ వెరీ డేంజరస్, ఇట్ ఇస్ నాట్ గుడ్.
అనేక విషయాలు మనము ప్రపంచమునకు ప్రబోధించవచ్చును.
వీ మే ప్రీచ్ మెనీ థింగ్స్ టు ద వరల్డ్.
మీరు టన్నులు టన్నులు స్పీచ్లు ఇచ్చేదానికంటే ఒక ఔన్స్ మీరు అనుభవించండి చాలు.
ఇన్స్టెడ్ ఆఫ్ డెలివరింగ్ టన్స్ అండ్ టన్స్ ఆఫ్ స్పీచెస్, ఎక్స్పీరియన్స్ అన్ ఔన్స్ ఆఫ్ ఎట్ యువర్ సెల్ఫ్, దాట్ ఈస్ ఎనఫ్.
కనుకనే మనము నిత్య జీవితం లోపల ప్రాక్టికల్ ఆచరణయోగ్యమైనటువంటి దానితో ఈ ప్రచార ప్రబోధన సల్పాలి.
Therefore, in day-to-day life, we need to propagate and preach based on merit that comes from practice.
ఈ విధంగా భారతీయుల యొక్క విజ్ఞానము సర్వ శాస్త్రముల యొక్క సారముగా మారి సర్వ విద్యల యొక్క గమ్యంగా ఉండి దివ్యమైనటువంటి జీవితానికి ఇది ఒక సూత్రంగా ఏర్పడినటువంటిది.
In this way, the Bharatiya knowledge, having become the essence of all the scriptures, being the destination for all pursuits of learning, has become a connecting thread to a divine life.
And that was the next clip in that discourse for those of you who are wondering whose voice it is translating, we had retranslated this discourse. The voice that you heard was that of Brother Sunil from Radio Sai. And what do we say? Swami is saying in the end, you can go on speaking and doing hundreds of programs of Shravanam Mananam, and if you're not following, then there's no point. I mean, that's what it appears like. Something which Swami often says, that one spoon of a cow's milk is better than barrels of donkey's milk. That's what Swami would say. And he would say, one spoon of cow's milk is nothing but practicing whatever little that you have learned. But much before that, Swami is talking about the approach of science. And as I think we had mentioned it last week also, it's not necessarily the approach of science, but it is the approach of half knowledge of science or taking recourse in science. Because the people who are really with that scientific approach, they do not have this feeling that they know everything or everything is already known. They have much more humility than people who actually claim in the name of science, right?
And Swami used to actually say, you know what, Hiranyakashipu in Trai, that he had even traveled to the stars.
Right.
So the achievements of Hiranyakashipu would be so like exaggerated, saying that he did this, mm-hmm. he did that. But Swami is very clearly saying that this kind of the knowledge that he had or the achievements that brought within him a certain pride. So innately, as such, there's nothing wrong with those achievements.
Mm.
Not to say that the achievements by themselves are wrong in any sense, but it is the aftermath that on the person. Like the same thing when you look at knowledge, Swami says, or rather education. Swami says that Vidya Dadati Vinayam. So that is the one of the end objectives of education, right, is to create humility.
Mm.
And last segment we were discussing that how this kind of humility is the characteristic feature of those who are at the edge of science.
Mm.
They have not closed their mind to, you know, that we have achieved. Like even a person like Newton would be so humble as to say that he's merely, you know, like touched the shores of knowledge, or that he's, what he could see was because he stood on the shoulders of many giants who had come before him. So they are aware, you know, that it's really such a vast amount of knowledge that is still to be, you know, tapped into, or that these are phenomena we were discussing, that we are studying phenomena that can be studied, right? So with that is the kind of humility that is exhibited by them. A. B is the, again, with the scientific method, there is nothing wrong in it. Right? However, it becomes paradoxical when you take that scientific method and try to beat everyone else with it, because you hold a certain belief. Whereas science says that belief itself needs to be questioned. Right? Even a belief in science can be questioned. Like we have in scientism, that science can explain everything. It is a very antithesis of a scientific temper to say that it can explain everything. Right? It's to stand in like, I don't know. Which is the spiritual aspirant always stands in a place that I do not know. That, you know, the Zen story of that, it's said, you know, that a professor, he goes to a Zen monastery and he wants to, you know, like get that enlightenment. So he sits in front of the Zen master and he says, like, I want enlightenment. So the Zen master does something very strange. He says, okay, let's have tea. So he's an English professor and he like obviously takes to that idea. And when the cup of tea is brought in front of him, the Zen master, he says, I want to pour the tea. And he holds out his cup and he's talking and he's smiling and he goes on pouring the tea. The tea starts overflowing, but he's still pouring it. And at that time, the professor can't take it anymore. He says, what on earth are you doing? The tea, the cup is full and you're still pouring. And he says, that's precisely how you have come to me. Your cup is full and you want me to pour knowledge into that cup. And it's a very fantastic concept. I think, again, we have explored this like long back. But the fact that a spiritual aspirant has to be a learner to begin with, like that what they call as a beginner's mind, even down to that if you have already heard the concept, right, you got to set aside anything you know about that concept and hear it as if you're listening about it for the very first time. You know, that kind of wonder, right? So that is the hallmark of a spiritual aspirant. So they say that when you meet a teacher, actual teacher, you're actually meeting humility itself. And we have seen with our own teachers that kind of humility in one sense, it inspires you to learn.
Mm.
And also learning happens, like, that is a space in which learning happens.
Right.
That kind of humility.
Yes, somebody very graphically represented it, you know. If you look at the earth, if you stand on different points of the earth and you'll say that no, this is this country and that is that country.
Hmm.
And there'll be a lot of differences, you know. No, this is, it snows here. No, it's very warm there. There will be differences. But actually, the people who go deeper, they will know that they will all reach at one point. I think any concept is like that. Those who are in the fringe of that concept, be it religion, be it science, I mean, they are given to fanaticism and say that, you know, this is what it is, this is how it is. But those who actually go deeper in anything, you know, you don't have to stand in Bharata Bhumi and in the land of spirituality and dig deep. Even if you're in the land of, say, I mean, you start with music, you start with science, you start with excellence in anything, the deeper you go, you're actually going to come to the same core. And most of the people who even fight in the name of religion, fight in the name of science, fight in the name of any belief system, are people who, in a very superficial manner, hold on to that belief system. As you're saying, that as a belief system that you have to hold on to.
Mm.
I think those are the people who actually come up and fight with each other. I mean, what you beautifully described as what is necessary for a man of science is very much applicable for a spiritual aspirant. The learner's mind is as much necessary for a spiritual aspirant as it is fundamental for scientific exploration.
Exactly. Right? Yes. So that is a danger which Swami is warning everybody against. It's not the achievement. It's not academics. See, again, like we're not smearing pursuit of academic excellence or of professional excellence. That's not the point. The point is that you get consumed with, or you get attached to that, and your image of you being like lording over that kind of knowledge or lording over that kind of achievement.
Mm.
There is a certain, we were looking at this, exploring this concept a long time back, when we were talking about service, that where you stand today, like how much of it are you responsible for that directly?
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you look at it, the various events that took place, the barriers that others experienced and you didn't, right? If you look at all of that, like that is what will bring you to a certain humility, that the achievement, the way it happened, there is very little of you.
Right.
And let's take chance out of it, let's take destiny out of it. You got to understand that how much society put into you so that you could get there. Right. That is why Swami says, you know, that seva is basically you giving back to society out of the recognition, that kind of humility, that I am where I am because you made me so. Right? Like, it's not a political statement, but the entire society has contributed to you being here at this. They've tolerated us and put up with all kinds of things so that we could get here. So that is the humility that Swami wants to get in. Because on the one side, as we said, you know, the learning will stop. The moment this arrogance comes in, the learning will stop. And that is the last thing, you know, that a spiritual aspirant can hope for. Afford, stagnation.
Right.
Yeah.
In fact, sometimes Swami refers to the physical or external exploration and the internal journey as, you know, the Pravritti Marga and the Nivritti Marga. Pravritti is going outward and going inward. It's a very beautiful example that Swami gives, I think, in one of the Samukhoses again, where Swami says, you know, you have a mango in front of you, and there are a certain ways by which you can make out whether that mango is ready to be eaten or it is overripe and you can't eat it now. And from the smell, from the texture of the skin, or how soft it is. So Swami is saying that you are using your external understanding of a mango to identify whether that mango is edible or not. Swami said that is something like Pravritti Marga. That you have a certain external knowledge, you use it. And Swami says, okay, you find the mango worthy of eating, and then you start eating it. What is it that stops you from saying that I've had enough? Swami said that is Nivritti Marga. And Swami went on to explain that limitation or that idea of that intelligence comes from, what is the purpose of eating a mango at all? Like, if you know that that mango is being eaten for the nourishment that it gives and for that limited pleasure that it can give you, then you will ensure that you're within that circle of purpose. And that comes from Nivritti. That comes from the inner exploration. So when Swami is talking about science and spirituality, yes, that external study, I mean, that's why Swami has set up a university and we all have studied science and humanities and business in that. Because that knowledge is meant for a certain amount of secular learning to fend for yourself in the world. But that is where it stops. The purpose part of it actually always comes from that inner exploration or the spiritual study which Swami speaks
and,
about.
Paradoxically, see, the person who has done that inner explanation will enjoy eating that mango more.
Right.
Because
you'll know exactly the optimum amount to eat, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And like, yeah, so the one part is of course that, you know, the joy can be sustained for a longer time. But that's what I'm saying is the way we enjoy happiness is like we want to perpetuate it. Right, which is what causes a lot of sorrow to begin with, right? So if you look at a person like this who's enlightened, right, and the way they experience something or the way they enjoy something, like we can see, you know, Swami, like in private settings or like in an interview or he's talking to students in Thai, one thing you'll see is boundless joy, you know, boundless energy, just totally giving oneself. You know, you should see when we see the videos of Swami with students long, you know, in the early, say, 80s or 90s, it's like you cannot distinguish, like, who is a college student among them and, like, the way Swami used to scurry up the mountains in Ooty and that excitement, I think he would beat every student over there hollow in that energy, right? So, how do you reconcile that? Like you think that okay, like a person like that, he should completely, you know, take himself out of all this, the inner richness of the inner being. But no, they find that exact same richness outside, which we fail to do so because we get stuck to that happiness. We want to recreate that happiness every time, everywhere. They're not attached to that,
right.
And that's why they can find joy every place. Mm. You know. That's a beauty of the whole spiritual journey, that there it's filled with paradoxes of this kind, right?
Absolutely. You know, as they say, if there is an object which can give you pleasure, and if you're able to get all the pleasure from it, you don't need to indulge yourself in that.
Yeah.
You will get all the pleasure from it. But it's only when you're not able to get all the pleasure, you consume more of it thinking that you will get all the pleasure.
Exactly.
I mean, that's when I think, you know, all of us, we overeat and, or, you know, overindulge in pleasures.
Correct.
But if you look at Swami, I mean, every moment is completely lived. I think that is the idea of becoming spiritual. That you, when you, as they, going back to the Zen way of looking at it, they say when you listen, you actually listen.
Right.
When you drink, you actually drink. When you eat, you actually eat.
Hmm. Or they say, you know, the rocks are rocks and the mountains are mountains, and rivers are rivers.
Absolutely.
So they see the reality for exactly what it is, and they experience it exactly as it is.
Right.
There's no, you know, anything masala added, spice added to that.
Going back to this story of Hiranyakashipu, you know, even as Swami is speaking about Hiranyakashipu, the scientist, Swami is saying that he's explored and he's gone to the sun and moon. In a sense, if you look at it, Hiranyakashipu is someone who has probably looked everywhere where the people of religion, the people of who have propagated the scriptures have said, you know, this is where God lives. God lives in the sky, or God lives in the atom, or God lives here. Probably as a scientist, he has looked at all of those places. You know, when Swami says that he's gone to the sky, he's gone to the sun, I mean, he is somebody who can practically challenge you and say, I've gone up high, there is no heaven there. I've gone low into the ground, there is no hell. And probably even when he's asking Prahlada this question of where is your Narayana, I mean, if you look at it as a person who is probably, you know, in advanced nuclear science or something, he has opened up every atom and he has found that there is no God anywhere in that sense.
Right.
I mean, he can probably give the names of what are the components of each of these atoms which he has opened up. But now when he's asking this little boy, where is Narayana, and he says, you open anything, you break open anything and you'll find God there. I mean, what a moment it would have been for this scientist, as one of the very famous atheists says, that, you know, the greatest nightmare I have is one day to meet God, if I happen to bump into God, you know. This literally must have happened to Hiranyakashipu.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is that, actually Swami says that the whole experience, now, you know, it was like a sadhana for Hiranyakashipu.
Right.
That the whole time, See, the whole problem is this, that the entire time, because of all this knowledge, he has acquired a god complex. He's, you know, and for him, the idea that there is a rival god,
right,
that, so that his son himself worships like a god which is distinct from himself, that rankled him in him so much, you know, that became actually his obsession, called like, I should find out who this is.
Mm.
You know, I should find out who this is. And at the end, what Swami says very beautifully, that the pillar, the breaking of the pillar, it actually symbolizes like Hiranyakashipu's evolution. It's a strange thing. For the first time I'm encountering something like this.
Mm.
That the moment was a defining moment for Hiranyakashipu, rather than for Prahlada or for anyone else. Right.
Mm.
So the he comes face to face with divinity, and that's how, you know, the divinity emerged.
Mm.
Right. The story, of course, says that he was torn asunder physically, but now we get the whole picture, you know, that it was actually a moment of revelation for Hiranyakashipu, and the tearing of the body, and which is depicted, is him going beyond that body consciousness because of the obsession of with the Lord.
Right.
We see this happening to a bhakta, but for the first time, like, we see how Swami shows, you know, that that it is the earnestness of that the quest, right, which actually delivers,
right,
more than your technique, more than the aspects called the other aspects that surround it. It's the earnestness, right, which that one-pointed
quest,
seeking,
right,
of the Lord, which fetches the result.
Right. I mean, it's really fascinating to look at it as, I mean, as Swami puts it, Hiranyakashipu, the scientist.
Yeah.
Because many times, that's how the story goes, you know, he tries to crush him under the feet of an elephant, he tries to drown him in an ocean, but this boy survives everything, which actually beats scientific knowledge, I mean, logic. I mean, here is a person who's so scientifically looking at everything. Probably that's how Swami describes Hiranyakashipu. But his own son, who's like this, you know, a little tiny fellow, who seemed to be beating all scientific logic. The water is not drowning him, fire is not burning him. I mean, this is what happens when your scientific understanding is challenged. You probably try to look the other way, or you say that there is an explanation, I don't have it right now. But the final moment is when you're confronted with something you just cannot deny. And I mean, how many scientists we've seen or we've heard of that happening to when they come to Swami, right? You know, the most famous example they usually give is that of Dr. Bhagwantam, you know, who used to translate Swami's discourses. He was, I think, a professor of physics before he came to Swami. I mean, even after that, of course. And absolutely skeptical, and this phenomenal incident happens in the sands of Chitravati, where Swami picks up a fistful of sand and asks him to hold out his palm and literally pours sand into his hand, which in front of his eyes transforms into a book. And there is no way he's going to be able to explain that. And then he opens it, and it's actually a copy of the Bhagavad Gita. And as though that was not awe-inspiring enough, Swami points out, actually, that Bhagavad Gita is in Telugu, because I know you can't read Sanskrit, right? In multiple levels, Swami actually
customized
and beats every understanding of scientific approach that he had.
Yeah.
I think that's what happens to a science. I mean, as you beautifully said, spoke of, I mean, finally comes to that sincerity of the effort. It doesn't really matter to Swami that you deny Swami. I mean, you've denied Swami for 50 years, so you don't deserve my grace. I think that is never there. As long as you have been sincere in whatever you have taken as your path. And, I mean, of course, I don't think we can talk of Hiranyakashipu in that aspect, because he was also spoken of as a tyrant. But from Swami's point of view, you would say that, you know, it doesn't matter. You could be an atheist, but if you've been a good man, I think that's what we've seen in many devotees. They've been deniers of God, but they've been good people, and that reward is always there. That sincerity, I think, Mr. Raman Rao used to say that about himself, that he was actually an atheist when he came to Swami, and very, very deeply rooted in his philosophies. But he was a very good man, you know, that, if you can put it that way, that Sevadal in him was always there, literally waiting to be woken up. And when he came to Swami, it was just that devotion was waiting to happen. So in that sense, that sincerity, as you said, that's more important. I mean, you can not be a devotee and have that sincerity, but if you are a devotee and you know you lack that sincerity, actually you're missing out something.
Right. And it's quite a nice thing that you brought up Gita, because I was making that association, see, that he puts Prahlada through all those tribulations, like throwing him off a rock and he doesn't die. And he crushes him under the elephant, this thing, he doesn't die. Drowns him in water, doesn't die. And puts him into fire, doesn't die. But the Gita actually talks of the real person that you are as that which cannot be cut by a sword,
right,
that which cannot be wet by water, that which cannot be burnt by fire. And it is a metaphor for Hiranyakashipu going through that understanding that the body is not none of these, that who you are is none of that. And that culminated in this one experience, like an explosive experience of God himself being revealed. And Swami so nicely puts it that actually that's when the body consciousness totally drops off. So again, the beautiful experience I have, like when I'm going through the discourses, is a lot of these things beginning to make sense in that, you know, coming, the pieces coming together. I really wish, you know, that we had all the time in the world to go through in detail every one of Swami's discourses this way. This really was an eye-opener.
Very, very profound what Swami is saying. In fact, we've heard Swami say this, that you give up body consciousness and then you get atmic consciousness. But from an example, as you're saying, of Hiranyakashipu, and it is so relevant to today's understanding, you know, we're talking of science, scientific exploration, and how it actually, when it confronts something which it cannot understand, it's a quick redefinition of whatever you've learned. Because when Swami is talking about body consciousness, it's not necessarily the attachment to the body, but everything that is acquired through the body. If you talk of knowledge which is acquired through the body, being attached to that is also a form of body consciousness. Where, you know, they say that you believe that what you have learned through this experience of the body is only the knowledge that you have. But all of spirituality is an attempt to push you towards breaking that idea, that you have knowledge which is infinite, which is not acquired through this body, and all of that belongs to you. And that happens when you break this body consciousness. In fact, that there's a very beautiful talk by one neuroscientist in the US, Venkateshan or Dr. Venkatraman, you know, he speaks about that, where he does an extensive study on the concept of mirror neurons. And, you know, he was saying that, you know, when you're looking at another person, and let's say that that person is eating an ice cream or undergoing a certain trauma, a part of your brain, and which is an overwhelming part of your brain, almost like 20% of your brain, actually thinks that that experience is happening to you. And then he says, but there is this very strong idea in your brain that that person is not me. What we refer to as body consciousness. Where he said that this body alone is me and everything else around me is not me. And he says that that is the only thing which stops you from experiencing what the other person experiences. And they found that, you know, if we make, he talks of a beautiful experiment where there's a person sitting in front of this subject, and they touch that person's hand, and they say the brain is so quick that for a moment it thinks that the person's hand has been touched, but then it immediately sends signals to that part of the hand, and the skin sends back signals saying that no, this was not the hand which was touched. So the brain says, okay, it was not me. So they say, can you, if you snap this whole conversation which is happening between the, you know, the nerve cells in the hand and the brain, so if you anesthetize the hand and do the same experiment. So they say for a very, very short time, the brain actually gets fooled into thinking that it is happening to you. So he says, I mean, being a person of Indian origin, he goes on to say that this is what Vedanta speaks about. That if you can, with effort, overcome the body consciousness, remove this idea from the brain, from the mind, that this body is me, then you start interacting with everything around as part of you. And so every knowledge actually becomes accessible to you, not just the knowledge in this physical brain. It's very fascinating that, you know, the idea of going beyond body consciousness, what Swami is talking about, you know, as long as one identifies with the body, one is far away from God. And as Swami beautifully spoke of in a previous discourse, the idea of oneness itself is the idea of God, where the concept of Virata, Swami said, that everything put together is that divinity, one aspect of divinity. Literally.
And of course the closing part, like inescapable, I think, like is that Swami again speaking about practice. We did bring it up that at the end of it, all that knowledge will come to naught if we do not put it into practice, if we do not put it into play, so to speak, in our everyday life. See, the thing is this, that we are born with a certain set of beliefs, and they kind of, solidify around us.
Mm.
And then comes, you know, a spiritual being, and if we are very fortunate, Swami, who will come in front of us and challenge our very notions, like through miracles and through discourses, that the notions that you hold about who you are and what this world is, they may be incomplete. And, you know, therefore, when we listen to this, it's not about being fascinated with the idea that we are one. that high we have for a short while.
Right.
But Swami is asking us to go beyond that high of, like, either intellectually being happy about such beautiful ideas or, you know, to actually putting them to play in our everyday life.
Right.
That is where our real progress happens. And I think what we were speaking about, that's when we show our love for Swami truly.
Right.
You know, that in the end, I think what pleases Swami is that. You know, that the way that when we transform, when we move forward to Godhead, and we experience more of what He experiences.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
As we often say, you know, it's not about the Shravanam, it is not about the Nitidhyas, it's not about the Mananam.
Yeah.
You can listen to, as you were saying, endlessly all the discourses with Swami, and it would be a beautiful experience to go through in detail. And we can discuss endlessly about what Swami says. But eventually, I think the prayer should be for the Nididhyasanam to happen.
Exactly.
When the message becomes part of you, and every action is born out of that nourishment which comes from the message being internalized.
Yes, because there is a place for Shravanam and Mananam, because that's what we got in the last discourse.
Right.
That you need to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is a lot of tension that you will undergo if you just start behaving in a certain way, that, you know, you look at Swami and or appreciate the ideas as such and go do it. But like oneness, for example. But unless you get a true understanding of it, then it'll tear you asunder. So that is the caveat that Swami
has. It's like, I don't know whose quote it is, somebody says about quantum mechanics. Anybody says that he has understood quantum mechanics, then he is not.
Oh, yes.
It's almost.
There isn't any understanding.
So if you're not being disrupted after going through Swami's message, then you're ignoring something or you're looking the other way, I guess. It should upset you. It should stir something within you.
It should put you off balance.
It should put you off balance, exactly. So I think we'll conclude with that, dear listeners. Thank you for joining us. We most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. There is still a few more clips to complete this discourse. We hope you'll join us again next week at 7:30 p.m. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his guests for the last segment of today's live program, the Vahini Satsang. We'll meet you again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the continuation of this discourse. Thank you. Jai Sairam.